Hello and welcome to Smart Askers. I'm Lorena.
And I'm Robin. And today our guest is Dr. Alan Lurst. So Al, hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
Good. So you are living in Wisconsin.
Marinette, Wisconsin.
Okay. And you are here in Grand Junction, Colorado because you did a reading at the
University of Mesa, Colorado for the High School Writers Conference.
Right. It's Colorado Mesa University. But
Colorado Mesa University.
Yes. Right,
there's
Writers
a lot
Conference.
Of Mesa's and universities.
Al doesn't know where he is.
No, that's
I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea. Where are we?
And so you wrote a book called Dancing at the Gold Monkey.
Yep.
And in 2011, it won first prize in the Leapfrog Fiction Contest.
That's right.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank you. That's awesome. Yeah.
It was really exciting.
Yeah. What was that like? I mean, you submitted and
it was great. I got an email that said I was a finalist. And then about a week later, I got another email that said I won.
Whoa.
And there were 546 entries.
Wow.
And I rose to the top.
You did?
Yeah. So the woman who judged it is a pretty famous writer, Marge Piercy. And she's written a lot of novels and poetry. But she judged it. But she happened to be from Detroit and was anti-war protester during the 70s, Vietnam War and all that. So I think the book kind of spoke to her.
Because it's a book of short stories and they're based around Detroit and the Upper Peninsula.
Right.
The UP.
The UP.
Yes. Yeah. Is that what you call it, the UP?
The UP.
And do you call yourself a Uper?
I do not.
Can we call you that?
You can call me a Uper.
Okay, excellent.
People who live below the bridge, though, are called trolls.
Oh. Do they know that?
They know that.
Oh, that's funny.
Or they still choose that life for themselves.
Fudgies or apple knockers.
Apple
knockers.
Huh? Yeah.
Interesting.
Sounds like subhuman species.
Yeah.
They are, kind of.
Yeah. Now, so you're from the Detroit area. Did you ever live in Detroit?
I did. I lived in Detroit city proper when I was younger.
Okay.
And then we moved to a suburb just 3 miles north of 8 Mile.
Okay.
M&M.
Right.
Yeah, we're homies.
You're homies. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my daughter, who's a 12-year-old white girl from Western Colorado, is totally into the white guy rappers.
Really?
And she can sing the songs. She can, well, that's not the right vernacular.
I heard her rapping on Facebook.
She can spit the rhymes.
Does she like Vanilla Ice?
She doesn't know Vanilla Ice. No. Okay, anyway, so you're from the Detroit area. Do you visit Detroit now?
I do. I get down there a couple times a year.
Okay.
Yeah. And I grew up there, so I kind of know my way around, and mostly on the east side. But, Detroit's an interesting city. It can be a lot of fun. Pretty good music scene there still. Mm. Jazz and blues.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, when I go there, it's got such a bad reputation. I think it was rated the worst city by one of those magazines, whatever they are. Mm-hmm. But I grew up there. It doesn't seem that scary to me, just another urban place.
Sure.
But it's cool.
Yeah, it's a place that I would like to go see, because it is, it's like urban decay.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting.
Well, and all these buildings, there's like old opera houses and theaters that are just, falling apart, and it's kind of sad that would happen. But, you look inside, you've seen those photographs.
Yes.
Where there's, this beautiful artwork and stages and just...
Yeah, all the decorations inside.
Decorations and ornate, woodworking.
Yeah, it's like the fall of Rome.
Everything.
So you did a reading at the writers' competition at CMU yesterday. Tell us what the name of that story was.
The story's called Animush. It's actually pronounced Animish, and it's an Ojibwe word.
Oh.
And it means little dog in Ojibwe. But I call it Animush because the character mispronounces it.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And Animush is a dog.
It's a dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a dog that the central character came by sort of accidentally.
Oh.
Found it. Animush is a former sled dog.
So something terrible happens to the dog in the story?
The dog you know, follows the main character Ray around, and but he also, you know, he likes people, so he'll follow just about anybody. So he follows this one kid, Robbie, who's out in the river fishing, and he misses the rock and falls into the river, and much of the story is about trying to rescue that
dog. I know
dog.
When I was listening to the story, I just kept thinking, please let the dog be okay. And you saved the dog in the end.
In the end, yeah.
Yes. And
yeah.
You were asked by a student what was the inspiration. And I actually know this story, and I would like you to tell the story of
the inspiration.
Well,
yeah, I can't believe I told that story. But
you left out all the essential names. It could have been anybody.
We were camping in near Blue Mesa, and I think it's the North Fork of the Ford River that flows in there. I can't remember if that's
sure.
the right river or
Marina?
Not. But,
yeah. Yep.
But
I
yeah.
Agree.
Yeah. One of those.
Probably
rivers.
Ask Google later.
Yeah.
We'll just go with that.
It was
now.
Fast. Hmm. But anyway, some of the people that we camped with showed up with this dog, old dog, 16 years old, can't hear, can't see. And about a half hour, hour into our setting up, somebody says, "Where's Snickers?" And nobody knows. Snickers not to be seen. So we spend the rest of the afternoon into the evening searching for Snickers. Snickers is never found. We figure he must have waded into the river and was swept away.
That is so sad.
Maybe he put a rock in the pocket of his coat and decided this is the way he wanted to go.
Or maybe
it's very romantic ending.
Right. Like Virginia Woolf.
Exactly.
Oh, see?
Yeah.
His poetry was over. Snickers. You said in yesterday when one of the students asked about how you started writing, did you go to college right out of high school?
No. I got drafted.
Oh, how old were you when you got drafted?
19.
Holy cow.
Yeah. I was working at Chrysler, and it was the tank factory. They had a contract. They were building tanks for the Italians.
Oh.
And I worked there about 6 months, and I decided I didn't like factory work. So I quit, and I went up to, my parents had a cottage up in the Thumb area of Michigan, so I went up there to hang out. And then I got a call from my mother, and she says, "You have a letter here from the Department of Defense," and it was my draft notice.
Oh.
So I went in the Army.
How did you feel about that? I mean, when you got drafted, were you like, oh, no?
Yeah, I was like, oh, no, my life is over. What's going on here?
Did you know other people who had been drafted?
I didn't know them personally, no, but I knew people were getting drafted.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oddly enough, I met a couple people from Detroit when I was in Vietnam, and we kind of hung out together afterwards.
And did you serve
the war.
4 years?
Two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
year.
So when you get drafted, it's only 2 years?
Yeah, it was 2 year draft.
Okay.
And
well,
so I
that?
Did, you know, a year in Vietnam and then 6 months after that.
Oh, okay. Okay. And then you came home, and at one point did you decide to go to school?
Actually, I had a girlfriend at the time who said, "You would be a fool if you did not take advantage of your GI Bill."
Smart girl.
Yeah, you need girls to tell you that stuff. That's
So
I did that, you know, and I just kind of went for the money because it was, you know, it was pretty good pay for those days, 1971, 72. And so, you know, I got into school, and I actually kind of liked it. I didn't really care much for high school when I was in it, but I originally went to a community college, and I thought it was kind of interesting. So then I moved up to the Upper Peninsula and worked up there for a year and then went back to school at Northern Michigan University.
Okay. And you got your four-year degree?
I got my four-year degree
okay.
there. Yep, yep. And then I went to work for the Fish and Wildlife for 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
What'd you do there?
I was, probably not many people know what this is, but I was on sea lamprey control. And
oh, yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. They are, yeah, you've heard of them.
Right, Lorena? Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They are eels. They're actually fish, but they look like eels. And they latch on to game fish in the Great Lakes, like salmon and lake trout.
Uh-huh.
And they're parasitic. So our job was to hunt them down and destroy them.
So you, like, fished all day?
Basically.
Yeah.
We walked around on rivers with shockers and looked for the larvae.
And you shocked them?
Yeah, shocked them. Well, we shocked them to collect them to see how far they had gone up the river.
Oh.
And then the chemical crew would come in behind us and treat the river with chemicals.
Oh, okay. And so that's how they would...
They kill the larvae before they had a chance to go out in the river.
But it wouldn't kill the other fish?
No, not unless the chemical builds up, and like behind a beaver dam or something. Uh-huh. But otherwise, it's pretty safe.
Huh.
That seems like an animal with no redeeming qualities. Where did it come from?
It's actually, an ocean creature, and it adapted to fresh water.
Huh.
And the theory is that it came through the canals at the Welland Canal when it was built in, like, 1922 or something like that, around Niagara Falls.
Oh.
And so the theory is that it made its way upriver from there. But it also probably came in on the ballast of freighters.
Oh. Because
when they go in the ocean, they pick up water for ballast. And then when they get in the Great Lakes, they dump the ballast.
Oh.
So you assassinated eels for 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you did, that was all you did is just the eels?
Basically.
Yeah. Wow.
It was really fun trying to lasso them, and, sometimes you had to have a chair and a whip, but, it was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, you're out in nature,
yeah,
which
I was,
you like to
I
be.
I was working on, worked in boats or was in the woods or on a river or on a lake, and we covered all the Great Lakes, so I worked all the way from Pennsylvania, New York, all the way over to Wisconsin and Minnesota.
And what were the kind of people that you worked with?
They were, educated.
I wish you could see Al's face, because it's very, questioning of the education.
Well, our job consisted of going out for 9 days, so we worked 9 days and had 4 days off, so we spent a lot of time in motels, and we were all young, we were all in our young 30s, so, we spent our evenings playing pool, drinking beer.
It's not a bad life.
No.
Assassinating eels by day, playing pool by night.
Killing lampreys by day, chasing women at night.
I see the next reality television show in this right now. You had to hurry up and write this before somebody steals this story.
Yeah. John Hendrickson from Discovery lives very close to here.
Really?
Let's go pitch it.
Yeah, he's in Gateway.
Let's go pitch this story.
Yeah. You call it Lamprey Shore.
Lamprey Shore. After Jersey Shore. Yeah.
Could you guys not wear shirts?
Right. Could you? Wife beater shirts.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Baby, have you seen this lamprey?
There you go. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The size of the eel I have in my pocket.
Yeah. Is it an eel in your pocket? Or...
Oh, yeah. This is in development. This is happening.
Yeah. No one better steal our idea.
That's right.
So you worked for the wildlife for 10 years, and then... why did you leave?
I got to be 36, 37 years old, and I was getting tired of being on the road and living out of a suitcase. So, I was a seasonal employee, so I had been laid off in the winters. And so I decided to go back to school and got my master's at Northern Michigan University in a couple of years. And then I had a really good mentor named Ron Johnson who said, I think you should go do the PhD. But I was turning 40, and I said, I don't know, I'm going to be 40 years old. And he said, time's going to go by regardless. Mm. So he was very encouraging. He was a good mentor. So I went down to Oklahoma State and did the PhD there.
I love that line, time's going to go by regardless.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I read that, and you had written an essay about your advisor in your PhD program.
Right.
And you had so many great things to say about writing and what you learned and what your approach is. And you said something that really resonated with me and I think a lot of other people who are interested in writing. You talk about you wish that creative wasn't part of the title of classes.
Right.
That you don't teach creativity. You teach the craft of writing. And I think that that kind of ego beat down happens a lot with beginning writers, that you have to teach them you have a craft to learn.
That's right.
You have something creative in you, and that's fantastic, and now you're going to do the hard work.
Yeah.
But I loved that approach. And tell me how you get that across to your students.
Yeah, that's hard to do. And I kind of tell them that, when I start the class. I give them that little anecdote that I don't really like that word all that much, because creative seems to imply that you can just do whatever you want,
Right.
And, paint a picture with your thumb or whatever.
You're genius.
You're
it's all genius.
Wonderful.
Yes,
I say,
you're
that's great when you're five.
But, I love it.
As an adult, you want to start thinking about this as an art, because that's what it is. And so I'm, pretty serious with them right away and try to encourage them to begin thinking about, asking questions like, what makes a story? How do you know it's a story? What makes a poem? And most of the time they say, well, it rhymes, you know. Yeah, if it's a Hallmark card, it's great, you know.
So what makes a story to you? Because that's something you talked about.
Well, it took me a long time to learn the craft of writing. I mean, it wasn't something that I came by easily. It was difficult for me to learn it, and I'm still learning it because you can't exhaust it. You know, there's just a million ways you can do it. But a story for me was, you know, basically strong characters. When I finally understood that my characters needed to know something, then I realized that they had a reason for being. And so you could put them in whatever situation, but there has to be some kind of, you know, kernel or grain or gem of wisdom in the characters so that your readers are, you know, saying, oh, yeah, I can relate to that. Maybe that's not my experience, but I see that. And I think it, in order to create good characters, you have to first think about the voice, you know, who's talking to me and why. And characters usually want something. They need to want something. They need to have desires that create conflict and tension.
Have setbacks.
Yeah.
And you have to let them get bruised and battered along the way.
Yeah. And they can't be, like, you know, totally good or totally evil, because then they're comic book, you know, they're cartoons. And that's okay if you're writing comic books.
I think that's my favorite kind of character, are the ones that are, you know, inherently are doing bad things, but you still are sympathetic for them.
Yeah,
you because have, they're human and they have some sensibility.
Yeah, you have empathy for them, even though, you know they're messed up in some way, but that humanizes them because we're all like that.
Yes, yes. And I appreciate that. I always like the characters that are, like, very flawed, but they are still good. Because I think, that could be me if I tried harder.
Yeah, absolutely.
I could be good, too.
Or I can just go on the flawed side of the continuum.
Right.
Whatever.
I've been riding
it's a continuum.
I've been riding a flawed character for a long time.
Right.
You also wrote about the story, The Point Man?
Right.
Kind of being in your head for 8 years?
Right.
Do you think that every story you have is in your head somewhere and it's just a matter of getting that story out? Do they live with you?
Yeah, I think that's true for some stories. In Dancing at the Gold Monkey, what I found to be true was that I had written a couple of stories that had the same characters in them. And whenever I had written those stories, other characters were introduced. So then I began to think, well, that character must have a story as well. So they started spinning off these people that were just kind of like introducing themselves to me. And then I was struggling with, well, what is their story? What is that person's story? You know, what's her story? What's his story?
I love that.
And so, you know.
See, writers are never alone. They've always got this cast of characters in their head. Those are your people.
Yeah. It's sort of like a Sybil-like thing. You
know? But in a productive, interesting, positive way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you're sharing those people instead of just acting out through them.
You know, and in some stories, I have been in my head for a long time. I just finished a short story that is going to be about the Purple Gang, which was a gangster gang in Detroit in the 20s during Prohibition.
Actual gang. This is based on
this
history.
This is actual gang, yeah. And they are contemporaries of Al Capone. In fact, they had some dealings with Al Capone where they would control, you know, the Detroit market, and the Capones controlled the Chicago market. And my grandfather, what inspired me to write the story was my grandfather had told me when I was like 12 or 14 that he knew one of the people in the Purple Gang.
Ooh.
And it was funny because my grandfather would say, yeah, he was a nice kid. And they were, you know, an especially ruthless gang. I mean, they had no qualms about killing people or, you know, taking territory. And there's a lot of stuff like that going on. So that actually has been, you know, germinating in my head for a long time.
I'm looking forward to reading that. How do you publish your short stories when you... I know, because some of these have been published elsewhere before they came in, became part of your book.
Yeah, I just try to target journals that I think, you know, have some merit. I kind of rank my journals like A, B, C, you know. And so, you know, like Paris Review would be an A journal. I know I'm probably not going to get published there because I don't write the kind of stories that Paris Review publishes, but it would be nice. But, you know, so then I start targeting, like, maybe some university journals, like Alaska Quarterly Review, where I published, Hawaii Review, Chattahoochee, which is down in Georgia Perimeter College, and places like that.
What about the short story structure appeals to you?
I like the short story because it is a form where you don't have much leeway with incidents or scenes or characters that are peripheral to anything. Hmm. Everything has to mean something, you know, whether it's the setting or whether it's moving from one place to another. It has to, in some way, build that moment, however long it is, if it's, you know, a 5-page story or a 20-page story. So everything should be contributing to the overall effect that I think you're looking for as a writer.
When you write your stories, because, you know, I've been reading your book and then hearing your reading yesterday, you use very specific names. Are those actual names of places in Michigan?
Yes.
Okay, and then I was reading, and I can't remember which story it came from, Penobscot.
Oh, the Penobscot building?
Yeah, so that's an actual building.
Yeah, and that was in a story called The Kiss.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's an actual, that's probably one of the oldest skyscrapers in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look it up. Because yeah. I read that and I immediately thought of MASH because Margaret Houlihan's husband, yeah, she was married to a man, for his last name was Penobscot.
Really?
And that's wow. Where it took me to that immediately. I was
that's
like, I wonder
good
if
trivia
he took it from MASH 30 years ago. So it's an actual building and not a reference to MASH. Okay, that's fine too. Yeah. And so is that, do you have to like get a map out and research this stuff, or are you just writing from your memory?
Actually, in the Gold Monkey book, I'm writing mostly from memory, but, in the one story that's, called, what is it called? Places Part Dream. No, that's not it. Yeah, it is called Places Part Dream. How about that? So anyway, I did some research there because I had been to Key West. After I got out of the Army, I went down to Key West, me and a girlfriend, we hung around for a few weeks, and I wanted the story to take place there, but I couldn't remember what I had seen. Mm-hmm. And so I went online and I started looking at maps and found the name of marinas and birds that were indigenous to there. Okay. So I could pull these details out, mm-hmm. because, you know, without details, you know, you have nothing. You've just got this sort of ethereal void, you know, abstraction. So you need to make it
real. And if you use the wrong names or animals, right, then people know that it's not authentic.
Yeah. I think people who want to write stories should be willing to research a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom Wolfe, I mean, is notorious for having a band of people who research everything that he's writing about.
Oh, yeah.
So that he creates, he hires interns or, you know, assistants. Right. And they research every aspect of whatever he's writing about.
Yeah.
And then he uses those facts.
Yeah. Verisimilitude, right? I think that's what it's called.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something that you make that's real seeming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because that's what I was getting. You know, the place names, and you're talking about the highways, and, you know, all of that, I just felt like it was rich. You know, you're adding a richness, because, you know, I don't know where that is, but I felt like it was genuine to the story. I believed the stories.
In Anamush, I lived in Marquette for 15 years, so I was pretty familiar with all those places. Mm-hmm. So those are right from my memory.
Mm-hmm. Also, when you were talking about riding the Point of Man, you made an observation that, because I want to get back to that, I'm interested in that. That you made an observation that you went back and forth on a point of view.
Right.
And you ended up with partial omniscience?
Yeah. Actually, Point Man started out in first person. Then it went to third. That was the third person omniscience. And then I decided to go back to first person, because if you do third and you have like a limited omniscience, you can comment outside the character's consciousness a little bit, you know? So, but I really wanted this to be from that character. So I switched it back to first person because I wanted the reader to see everything through this person's eyes.
It took me back to a class I had as an undergrad. It was a creative writing class, I believe. And the professor he really only commented on one thing on stories, point of view error. That was it. And he would just write in red, POV, right. POV, or POV. He never said anything else about the story. And that always bothered me. It's like, do you recognize a transition? Do you recognize a good quote? Do you recognize a rich detail? But it haunted me that he never commented on anything. And partly that led me to want to get a graduate degree in English and just have other professors and other feedback.
Yeah.
And partially when I taught later, it really drove it home for me that my students need to hear certain things from me.
Right.
And if I don't comment, if I don't note things, they may never get that feedback in their careers. And so I always felt this compelling need to really react to their writing, which makes for a hell of a lot of time grading papers.
Yeah, it's laborious, yeah.
But I felt like I needed to do that. I mean, what's your approach to giving feedback to
beginning
writers?
I usually look for what I feel or see as an interesting voice at work, because voice is really hard to talk about because it sounds real abstract. But what you're talking about, when you're talking about voice, you're talking about a lot of things. You're talking about stylistic things. You're talking about diction, word choice. You're talking about sentence length, even punctuation itself. You're talking about images, using the right image and the word to create that image to evoke an emotional response from the reader. But students don't recognize when they have these little gems embedded in their stories. Hmm. And all of a sudden, this voice will like leap out of this paragraph and it'll be really interesting. And I'll say, there it is. There's your voice.
Wow.
Yeah. Now make the rest of the story do that.
There you go.
You know?
Ah, well, yeah. your students are lucky to have your level of engagement with their writing.
I mean, that makes
a huge difference in a development of a writer. And they have to know how to talk about their writing.
Right.
And that's how you know how to work on the craft.
Yeah.
You have to be able to talk about the pieces and the parts of what's working.
They find
it
really interesting. I did this assignment where I took a small passage from Virginia Woolf, and I took one from Hemingway, and I took one from, who was the other one? I can't remember right now. But what we did was we compared the three different voices together, and they're very distinct. So, you know, generally readers think that writing is just writing. You know, like you're just reading. And unless you're trained, you know, you don't recognize how voice is controlled. And you have to be taught that. You know, I don't think that's something that comes natural to a reader.
Exactly.
And so we examined, you know, I said, look at Hemingway. He's just pared this down to its barest essential thing, you know, and that's why we call it minimalism.
Exactly.
But, you know, he's not like Virginia Woolf, who is using lots of long, really long sentences, larger vocabulary, more description, totally different voice.
And what's interesting, too, is, you know, minimalist is not just using fewer words. It's using just the right.
The right word, yeah.
And it's more disciplined. It's much more difficult.
Yeah. And Hemingway's good at it, you know.
Yeah, when I read him, I hear him.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like he's in the room with me.
You know, sometimes he got a little silly, like when he's talking about the tanks rolling into Milan, I think it was, or one of those Italian villages, and he says, and the tanks came into the villages and they had guns, and some of the others had guns. They had big guns too.
Okay. Like Dr. Seuss.
All right, that's not your best work anyway.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I think he was drunk when he wrote that.
Like there's something wrong with that.
He's supposed to drink after he's writing,
right?
Not while he's writing.
I think, you know, because I'm an art historian. I'm not what is an Englishtarian? I mean, what do you call yourself?
Englishtarian.
I don't know what you call yourself. An English person.
Englishinators.
Yes. I don't know. Writers. It's interesting listening to
critics.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not too big time. It's interesting listening to you guys talk about, you know, literature and like you saying, you know, Hemingway, that's not your best work, because for somebody like me, I'm like, oh, it's Hemingway. Every word is, of course, perfect. And
yeah.
And I'm actually intimidated by you know, those kinds of big names, because I'm like, I'm never going to get this. This is going to be too hard for me, and I'm just going to read Harry Potter.
That's an interesting comment, because I learned a lesson about that from that mentor I had, Ron Johnson, who we were reading, I think it was a literature class I had with him, but we were reading Faulkner. Genius, right?
Yeah.
And
okay.
We were reading The Sound and the Fury, which is like this fantastic, complicated, literary, genius thing. And, you know, I said, no one can do what he does. And he goes, well, he said, have you read Soldier's Pay? And I said, no, what's that? And he said, it's Faulkner's first book. And I've got it here on my shelf, and here you go. Read it over the weekend and tell me what you think. So I read it over the weekend, and I came back, and he said, well, and I said, not very good. And he said, see? Even Faulkner had to start somewhere.
There you go. That's interesting. Yeah, Faulkner.
That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, because I read him in high school, and I thought, this is too hard for me. I need more spoon feeding when it comes to my. I need to know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen there's publications of Faulkner now where it's color coded to help you understand what's going on.
Oh, and he actually wanted to do that. I think it was published with Scribner in, 1950, whatever. But he actually wanted to color code it, and they said no, because, number one, you got to think that your readers have enough intelligence to understand the book, right?
Right.
So you don't want to insult their intelligence. Number two, it's too expensive.
Right, really expensive.
Yeah, full color on every page?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Right,
no.
So they weren't going to do that, you know. But now we have the technology that makes that easy.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think he was right not to do that, because otherwise it would distract from its, beautiful complexity.
And it's good to be challenged. I mean, because I did actually start to appreciate, but I would never say, I'm just going to read Faulkner while I'm sitting around.
Right.
I mean, I was glad that I read him when I did, but I was, I never went back to him.
Yeah.
He's for nerdier Englishites.
Yeah. Well, he's complex,
I don't know. I'm going to come up with a name.
They just keep throwing him out there. Something's going to stick to the wall. It's just a matter of time. I know, too, that you've written about, Vietnam. And I'm interested in that, particularly because my father served in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He wasn't drafted. He was already...
Oh, my God, I feel old now.
Well, I'm sorry. He's much older than you.
Oh, okay.
Much, much older than you.
I feel bad.
But he was already enlisted, and it ended up being his career. And I'm always interested in, what do you think that people still don't know all these years later about Vietnam?
Oh, that's kind of an interesting question, because what they don't know is what's happening right now with soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq. And they didn't know it then, and they're still having a hard time knowing it now. But what they didn't know then was that when people come back from combat, they are not the same people. They are forever changed.
Right.
And that can have all kinds of degrees to it, and right now we're getting, soldiers returning from these other, our most recent wars, and they're in our classrooms right now. And so, they obviously have been traumatized to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's very difficult for the general public to understand that and know that, because, you're indoctrinated to try to not have emotion about anything, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to perform.
Right.
And so when you do perform and you come back, then you're asked to be normal, quote unquote, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that normality is confusing. You don't even know what it is anymore, because you're working on a different moral plane. Your values have been tested, and you may have survived it and you may not have. And so, it's why we have right now 18 suicides a day.
Yeah.
And that's almost, that's over 4,000 soldiers a year, male and female, who are committing suicide because they have been traumatized and they still aren't getting the help that they need to, be reintroduced back into society.
Hmm.
And you get these images and they don't go away. I mean, it's not like you can get better from them.
Mm-hmm.
You can compartmentalize them, you can rationalize them and talk about them, but they don't go away because they're so crazy. War is insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you in Vietnam?
I was north of Da Nang, probably 100 miles or so at a place called Fubai, mm-hmm. right on the coast. And I was with the 101st Air Mobile. So basically we just got on choppers and they dropped us got somewhere in the jungle and we walked around. I never knew where I was.
Yeah, my dad was a helicopter mechanic at Da Nang.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was like a city, right?
Yeah,
it is. I mean, it was huge.
It's a major city in Vietnam, yeah. Huh. Great beaches.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they had good surfing there, right?
Good surfing,
yeah. I've heard a lot of that. Yeah. There's a whole revival in people who served that are coming back and surfing and enjoying the...
Mm-hmm. It's actually becoming quite touristy.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? Would you go there on vacation?
I would go there in a heartbeat. I would go just to check it out. You know, one of my students, great young girl, 20 years old, Vietnamese, going to school in Marinette. And so I've talked to her about Vietnam and what's going on there. And she's, you know what, two generations removed now
right.
from that war, right? And it's really bizarre because, you know, not even important to her. It's not even on her radar.
Not even relevant.
Yeah, not even
that's
relevant.
Her experience.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really interesting because, you know, we still think of, I mean, that it's, you know, a big blemish, all the Vietnam. And,
right, right.
You know, it's still something that, you know, is in our consciousness. Yeah. But the fact that, well, you know, maybe because it was their country, they're like, we're just going to put it behind us and move forward, which they obviously have.
Yeah, and I asked her, where do people go on vacation? Because, like, Hanoi and Saigon, which is Ho Chi Minh City now, but both of those places are really super urban and loud and noisy and polluted, just like any other city. Mm-hmm. And I said, where do you guys go on vacation when you want to get out of the city? And he said, a lot of people go to Da Nang.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's really interesting.
It's you talk about the different morality, the different normalcy. I mean, that has to be what binds vets together. I mean, I just always observe that vets seem to find each other. They spot each other. They have maybe an emblem on a hat, or they hear him say something, and it's probably a shared experience that other people can never really understand.
Yeah, it's very difficult for anybody who has an experience to relate to. So even when vets get together, a lot of times, and even if they've been in contact, they talk about the funny things that happened.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, isn't that what we all do?
I mean, we were doing that the other day.
Yeah. All right, Al. So would you do a reading from your book?
Yeah, this is about four paragraphs, I guess.
Okay.
It's from a story called A Kiss, and it's about a character. His name is Kadoski, and he's wandering around looking for a friend of his, Mickey Mickiewicz. And so he's going to all the places where he thinks his friend might be, and he goes to this place that's called Ma's Pool Hall. And Ma is a large woman who can't get out of her chair, but she runs his pool hall. So he goes in and he says to Ma, "You've seen Mickey?" Kadoski says, "I seen a lot of things," says Ma. "Could be I seen Mickey. He got too many troubles this night." "How Ma know that?" "She tell you when you kiss her and puts her fingers to her lips." She edges forward in the light and Kadoski sees a speck of ceiling plaster on her bare shoulder, near the strap holding the cloth covering her like a tent, her milky white eyes larger in the light, red veins closing in on her dark pupils, the quivering flesh of her throat. "Ma ain't gonna hurt you, soldier boy." Kadoski smells lavender and cigarettes, and something's lodged in Kadoski's throat. He can't move. Ma cradles his head, her hands smooth against his cheeks, the touch of her palms like paper or wax, like his mother's hands felt the night he woke to a kiss, her cool lips pressed against the cold sweat on his forehead, and his mother saying, you're home," because he was gasping for air and half conscious, the bed sheets heavy as fallen beams and earth. Then Ma's mouth is wet on his lips. "Ma knows things," she says, and leans back in the big chair, Kadoski inhaling the air around her as if it were only enough for him. The glass doors to Ma's pool hall rattle when Kadoski opens them, and before stepping into the street and closing the doors behind him, the old woman lights another cigarette, her face glowing in the darkness around her. "You gonna see like Ma," she says. Gabriel's, that's where Mickey's going.
Ah, oh, that's great.
Oh, that is.
It's the richness, like I said.
Sensory detail.
Yes.
Yeah, just the right specific detail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know I was getting chills yesterday listening to your story, and I think it helps, you know, having you read it. And do you like reading your stories?
I do. You know, it's always, you know, it's a performance, so it's nerve-wracking. Mm-hmm. You know that, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, once I'm into it and I feel, like yesterday, I thought the audience was great. High schoolers, you never know how that's going to play out, but I was looking over the audience as I read, and they were actually listening, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that made me feel better. But yeah, I do like reading it. Yeah. I like it because it helps to connect. I've already had two students who took my creative writing class because they heard me read,
ooh.
Which made me feel really good.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because I never know how I sound as a reader. I don't know if I'm doing it right or good or what, you know.
You know, I've had the last couple of years, I've had the occasion to go to a lot of book readings. It was like being back in grad school again. And I'm so sorry I haven't gone to more in the intervening years, because it makes you appreciate mm-hmm. what a delight it is to have someone read to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a child, you'd start with that. But the idea of someone reading to you is just so pleasurable that, you know, I know that yeah. I'll never go that many years again without making that part of my life. And so I appreciate you and the other authors who yeah. make that effort.
I like going to readings. You know, some of them are really successful. Some of them maybe not so much. But, mm-hmm. you know, who knows? Maybe the person's having a bad night or something. Yeah. You know, it's hard to say.
Or they're starting exactly. and they don't, you know,
yeah,
it's hard for them.
Right.
That idea of storytelling was something that we actually talked about yesterday after Al's reading. One of the professors at CMU came up and said that she enjoyed it, and I said, it's like story time for adults. We don't have that. We don't have the opportunity to have people read us stories, just as you said. And I think that's a great thing, because, you know, and this is a completely kind of different experience, but when we're driving, I like to listen to books on tape.
Yeah.
And having mm-hmm. people yeah. read the stories. We drove to Las Vegas on the way there and back. We listened to Life of Pi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it, you know, I was like, and the things I didn't like about it is that when there was a turn of phrase that I liked, you can't savor it.
You, right. you can't go back and read yeah. it again.
Read it again. Yeah.
Read it slower.
And then,
it's just
yes.
moving
yeah.
forward.
Yes,
all the time.
Yeah. it's moving, and then you yeah. have to keep up. You have to keep up with it. But the idea of hearing somebody's voice say those words,
mm-hmm.
I it's just like, you know, kids listening to their parents read. They like it for a reason, and we stop doing it as adults. And
right, yeah.
I think we should yeah. do more of that.
I agree.
And it's interesting, because I think you guys probably know this, but I mean, I think there's psychological evidence for kids who are read to are more likely to develop an imagination and a love for reading because they hear these stories.
Mm.
And so they're saying now, you know, the sooner you can read, you know, quicker you can read to a kid, the better off that kid is going to be as far as understanding stories and, you know, relating to the complexities.
Mm-hmm.
of...
That makes sense, because the story is happening in your head. It's not
yeah.
playing out for you on the
right.
television
yeah.
or on the movie screen.
And there's evidence they've actually hooked people up to brain scans, MRIs, and they have them watch a video, and they have certain parts of their brain lights up. But when they're reading, they have them read something, then the synapses start to go crazy,
mm-hmm.
like sensory areas of their brain start lighting up. And so there's actually scientific evidence for the fact that, you know, reading is good for us.
Mm.
Yeah, well, that's the best way to learn. If you can tell a narrative about something instead of just presenting facts,
mm-hmm.
like even a scientist, if a scientist can tell you a story about that science and get you to understand it by using metaphors and analogies and anecdotes, you'll understand that science better.
Right, right, because you can relate it to
yeah.
more than just
yep.
the equations.
Yep.
And I think that's why we have, you know, stories, that morality is told in stories.
Absolutely.
Not just don't kill people.
Mm-hmm.
But
the story
of, you know,
that
yeah. came behind it. Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Sure.
That
yeah.
that's what sticks. It takes the sensory details to stick in your brain and create that story that lives in your head.
A sense of the happenings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not just lay down the laws.
Right.
Yeah.
What are you writing right now?
I'm working on two things. I'm in the fifth draft of a novel that I finished a few years back, and I'm going to try to get that done before Christmas. And I'm also working on the Purple Gang thing.
Exactly.
I just started on that.
Do you have a publisher for the novel yet, or are you still on the pre-publisher?
I don't have a publisher yet. I think with the novel, I was thinking I'd run it by Leapfrog Press, but I think I'm going to see if I can find an agent first and see what happens there.
Cool. Now, you said it was it's kind of a thriller?
Yeah, it's basically, it takes place in the UP. It's set in the UP.
Right, what you know, right?
Yeah, right what you know. And it's about a guy who's, you know, in his 60s, and he doesn't really have any ties, but he has, you know, a girlfriend. He's in love with this other woman from high school. And, you know, he hangs out with these ne'er-do-wells, and they have adventures. But in the meantime, right at the beginning of the book, you learn that a body has been found in the ore chute on the abandoned ore dock. And it's a skeleton, so it's been up there for more than a year. It's, you know, decayed into a skeleton. And it's a woman, and it's a young woman. And when they examine the body, when they examine the skeleton, they find that some of her teeth have been knocked out. Now, where that's going, I have no idea.
Oh, interesting. Won't you be interested to find out?
Yeah. I will be interested to find out because I don't know what happened. So through the course of the story, there's these little moments in italics where the main character is imagining it like a detective novel.
Oh, cool.
So he's making it up, you know. I mean, the fact that that happened is true in the story, but he's making up the detective part of it.
Oh, well, that's really interesting. See, I love thrillers and suspense and those kind of stories. So when you said you were writing that, I was very excited, and I can't wait until it comes out. So hurry up.
Yeah.
go live in that world for a while.
Yeah.
Don't you
feel
resentful when you just want to live in that world and finish writing and you've got to do other things?
Sometimes it's hard to get out of that world. Mm-hmm. You know, if you spend a lot of time in that story, you know, you're like this book. I spent so much time with these characters. I was a little like, well, where's my reality?
Now, do you miss them when you're done writing about them?
Yeah, in fact, somebody said, you ought to just keep that going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought, well, maybe that's not a bad idea, you know, just keep it going. All these people just keep telling stories about these people.
So the title of your book is Dancing at the Gold Monkey. And that's a great, great title because I would pick that up because I want to know about the Gold Monkey.
Yeah.
That's an actual place?
It's not really an actual place.
So you made up the name?
Yeah, I made up the name.
Love it.
Yeah,
it's okay,
a
so
strip club.
It's based on...
You know, I went to strip bars, you know, when I was in Detroit, when I was young. And, so, you know, and it was kind of like I was interested in that culture a little bit. And
you wanted to date strippers?
I wanted to reform them.
Oh. You would be the boy that they fell for.
I love that.
Not the one they would manipulate. Right.
No, we were just, you know, bad. But,
we were just bad.
Yeah. But, you know, I always thought that these characters needed to be a little bit on the creepy side, at least part of them, you know. And that's real. You know, it's a reality.
Mm-hmm. So you based the Gold Monkey location on experiences you had.
Yeah.
And how did you come up with that name?
The Gold Monkey... I just wanted, like, a kind of exotic name, you know? So I was thinking about, like, idols and statues. And
I could see a gold monkey statue at a temple.
Yeah.
It would make sense.
Or in an Indiana Jones
movie.
I kind
of thought it fit with a sort of exotic Vietnam maybe kind of thing.
When I saw that, I thought, oh, he must be telling stories about Vietnam.
Yeah.
That's what I thought it would be.
And so, you know... you know, basically the characters are just hanging out and they go there. But it's not really about what they do there. It's sort of peripheral.
Mm.
But the one story is called Take Me to the Gold Monkey. And that's about one of the central characters' girlfriends who's having an affair with, or wife who's having an affair with his best friend.
Mm.
And also pregnant. And she decides that she needs money. And the story is about her thinking about getting a job at the Gold Monkey because she's hard up for money.
It's either that or the typing pool. what's it going to be?
So what do you do now for fun?
Now for fun, basically I'm walking my dog a lot.
Your dog?
Yeah, Bobby.
Bobby.
Mostly, I'm mostly just working and watching episodes of Breaking Bad.
And
August,
Mad Men. I watched all of Breaking Bad.
Are you up to the last end?
Yeah,
of
I watched all four seasons. Now I'm watching Mad Men.
Okay.
Yeah, I binged on Breaking Bad, too.
I did, too.
So, Al, thank you very much for coming on to Smart Askers. We really appreciate it. I hope you had a good time.
Oh, it was great. Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
Wonderful.
Thanks for listening to Smart Askers, and we'll talk to you next time.
For more information about this podcast, you can go to our website, smartaskers.blogspot.com.